Stephen Hough and the BBC Symphony Orchestra play Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. That's Friday evening at 7:30, live on Radio 3. Back to this evening and Sunday, and now it's time for our Drama on 3. This week, it's an adaptation of Sandro Veronese's The Hummingbird, winner of the Premio Strega, Italy's top literary prize, translated into English by Elena Palla, adapted and directed by John Ritalak.
The Hummingbird by Sandro Veronese, translated by Elena Palla.
Bulgari, Tuscany, late summer 1981. Marco, age 22, and Luisa, age 16, are eating hot focaccia outside a shed among the pine trees encircling the beauty of Barati Bay. Restless, as two people who are about to rip each other's clothes off. They eat, share a beer, and don't speak much.
Is yours tasty?
Very.
Mine too.
Should we get another one?
They've both been waiting for this moment for a long time, and now they both know it will happen. Out there, soon, on the beach. Marco's been waiting for 2 years. Luisa for 5. Meanwhile, Giacomo, Marco's younger brother, stays at home and comforts himself with Nutella and half a bottle of his parents' rum. Though Marco is oblivious, Giacomo is also in love with Luisa. A mile further along the beach, Marco's older sister, Irene, is also in a peaceful and blissful state. Her mind switched off, untroubled at last. Her limp, hollow body tossed and tumbled by the waves, regurgitated by the whirlpools onto the shore where, at low tide, it'll be found.
You're right. I ran away, you say. It's true. But after what happened, I thought it was all my fault because I was with you when she drowned, because I was happy with you. I still think it's my fault. When I go to the beach, to Barati, and I think of you, and I think of Irene, of the happiness and the desperation that crash down on me at the same time, I'm afraid I'll lose them. Lose this pain. Lose the happiness. Lose you, Luisa, like I lost my sister. Don't you die too. Even if I've run away, wait for me. Forgive me. Hold me. Kiss me. Luisa, 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 Luisa.
Hi, Marco. It's me, Luisa, writing from Paris on my father's typewriter. I think of you often. You're the only Italian I find myself thinking of, apart from this other guy I can't quite get out of my head. I think of him when I'm sad, but of you when I'm happy. And not just when I put on your red jumper, like I did today. I think of you, especially when I'm in a taxi, in the small hours, on my way home from a party, late at night, tipsy, and I feel like merrily wasted potential. That's what you called me once. That's when I find myself thinking of you. I feel all the unnecessary things slipping away from me, and I realise that if you remove all the unnecessary things from my life, all that's left is you. I dream of you, Marco. Hugs, if I may, Luisa.
Rome, 18 years later. One of the key events in this tale of many tales takes place in Rome on a mid-October morning in 1999, and specifically at the corner between Via Chiana and Via Reno. What is about to happen here is a decisive and, one might say, potentially fatal event in the life of the main character in this story. Dr. Marco Carrera, ophthalmologist, reads the nameplate on the door which, for a little while yet, separates him from one of the most crucial moments in his life.
Good morning. My name is Daniele Caradori.
Marco Carrera.
Does my name ring a bell?
Should it?
Yes, it should.
What did you say your name was?
Daniele Caradori.
You're my wife's therapist?
Correct.
I never thought we'd meet. Please, take a seat. What can I do for you?
Are you Dr. Marco Carrera, aged 40, raised in Florence, with a degree in medicine from La Sapienza University in Rome, specialising in ophthalmology?
Yes.
Son of Letizia and Probo Carrera, both architects, both retired and living in Florence?
Yes, my father is an engineer, though.
You have a brother named Giacomo, a little younger than yourself, and living in the US, and, forgive me, a sister called Irene, who drowned in the early 1980s?
Yes, my sister took her own life at the age of 26.
You're married to Marina, a Slovenian national, working for Lufthansa?
Yes.
And you have a daughter, Adele, age 10, currently at a state primary school near the Colosseum?
Yes.
A few more questions, if you don't mind. You gamble, don't you?
Not anymore.
But in the past, would it be fair to say you were a gambler?
Yes.
And is it true that as a boy, you were much shorter than other kids your age, so much so that your mother nicknamed you the Hummingbird?
Yes.
And that when you were 14, your father took you to Milan to undergo experimental hormonal therapy, after which you grew over 6 inches in less than a year?
In 8 months, yes.
And is it true that you're in love with a woman named Luisa Lattes, currently living...
What? Who told you that?
Guess.
It's impossible. Marina could never have told
you. Only answer yes or no, please. Are you still in love with this Luisa Lattes? Yes or no?
Not at all.
So you're not secretly seeing her when you happen to attend a conference in France, or Belgium, or the Netherlands, or anywhere near Paris, where Miss Lattes lives? Or during the summer, where you happen to spend the month of August in 2 neighbouring holiday homes with your families?
That's ridiculous.
Look, I'm not here to judge you. I'm only trying to understand if what I've been told about you is true or false. It is false, then, that you and this woman are secretly seeing each other?
False, yes.
And you can't entertain the idea that your wife might believe this is true, even though it isn't?
Of course I can't. They've even become friends. I'm faithful to my wife and she knows it. And now, will you please tell me why I'd be in danger?
So you haven't been writing to each other for years? You and this Luisa, love letters?
Not at all.
Are you being honest, Dr. Carrera?
Absolutely.
I'll ask you one more time. Are you being honest?
Of course I'm being honest. Will you tell me...
In that case, I apologise. But it seems your wife lied to me. You're not in danger as I thought, therefore I won't bother you any longer.
Why are you getting up? Where are you going?
I apologise again, but I've made a serious mistake. Ever since your wife stopped coming to see me, I've been wondering...
What? My wife has stopped coming to see you?
Yes.
Since when?
Over a month ago.
Are you serious?
You didn't know?
No.
She hasn't been to see me since our last session, on the 16th of September.
But she tells me she's still seeing you on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 3:15. I pick up Adele from school, as always, because Marina is with you.
If this story about Luisa Lattes is only a fantasy of hers, that changes everything. And it's your wife who's in danger.
But why? What danger?
Look, I'm really sorry, but it's no longer appropriate for me to be talking
to you. It's not a fantasy of hers.
Beg your pardon?
What Marina told you about Luisa Lattes is not a fantasy. It's true. We're seeing each other, we write to each other, except it's not a relationship, and I'm certainly not being unfaithful to my wife. It's just our own thing, and I wouldn't know how to define it, and I can't understand how Marina knows about this.
Are you still in love with Luisa Lattes?
That's not the point here. The point is...
Forgive me, but I must insist. Are you still in love with her?
Yes.
You met in Lyon in June.
Yes, but...
In one of your letters from a few years ago, did you write to her that you like the way she dives into the sea from the shore?
Yes, but how on
earth... Did you and Miss Lattes take a vow of chastity?
How can Marina know about this? There's a marriage at stake here, for God's sake.
I'm sorry to say this to you, but your marriage has been over for a long time now, Dr. Carrera. Your wife will have another child shortly, but it won't be yours.
Marina, Marco's wife, was not innocent, but neither was Marco. It was while he was in Paris, early in 98, for a conference, in fact, that Marco Carrera found himself thinking again of Luisa. Not that he had never thought of her in those years. He thought of her practically every day. But those were vague, resigned musings on what could have been but never was. Feeble fantasies worn out by her absence, and made feebler still every time she reappeared at the beach in Bulgari in August, accompanied by her husband and children, one at first, then two. She was so far away now from the girl Marco had adored when he lost his sister Irene, and she kept getting further and further out of reach each year. But that afternoon in Paris, however, under an impossibly bright sky, Marco thought of her as someone close and attainable. During a break in the conference program, he called her from the Lutetia Hotel where he was staying. He tried one of his superstitious rituals.
Or if she does pick up but can't meet me, I will never call her again.
That never worked.
If this isn't her number anymore...
It didn't work.
If she doesn't pick up...
That was still her number.
If she does pick up but can't meet me...
She picked up in a flash, and in half an hour she was at the hotel bar where he'd suggested they meet.
Marco. My Marco.
Beautiful. Exhilarating.
Louisa, it is so wonderful to see you.
As if she'd just emerged, unscathed, straight out of Marco's past. But when a love story doesn't end, or in the case of Marco and Louisa, never truly began, it keeps haunting the lovers with words left unspoken and things left undone. It is true of every love story, but especially true for Marco and Louisa, because that afternoon, with that walk on Rue d'Assas and that innocent conversation, they started seeing each other again, which in their case meant writing to each other, often, passionately, like 19th century lovers, like they'd been doing 10 years before.
My dear Louisa.
Dear Marco.
Working and thinking of you.
Me too.
Louisa.
Marco.
And that correspondence was far from innocent, because now that they were both married and had children, they had to lie. They started seeing each other again all year round, because Marco made sure to only attend conferences within a 250-mile radius of Paris so that Louisa could join him. How she managed that, what she told her husband, was never mentioned. They went from staying at two different hotels to booking different rooms in the same hotel, until, inevitably, they ended up spending the night in the same room, in Lyon, on 24th of June 1998. And while France was beating Denmark in the World Cup finals at the local Stade de Gerland, Marco and Louisa's impossible love story culminated in the ultimate act of masochism.
I swear.
I swear.
A vow of chastity. And because of that sacrifice, no harm was done, they thought. No one was being cheated on. Nothing was being destroyed. They had never made love and swore they never would. They had only kissed once, that night, 17 years before, while Irene, his sister, was drowning, and swore they would never do it again. At the tender age of 39 and 32 respectively, Marco and Louisa actually slept in the same bed, without giving in to what they'd both fantasized about for years, without kissing, without cuddling, without even touching, without doing anything at all. Idiots, the pair of them.
Dear Marco, you know then that this is the definition of our love. That I never be where you are, nor you where I am. Hugs. Via post it's allowed. Louisa.
Marco really did believe that it was enough not to consummate his relationship with Louisa to preserve the one with his wife, Marina. And that's how colossally naive he was. Naive to a fault. To believe, as he did, that something so huge, with a conspicuous trail of evidence, would slip under the radar of a woman like his wife, Marina, really was a foolish mistake. Marco Carrera made that mistake, and he kept going day after day until it all came crashing down, safe in the knowledge that the only threat to his family's happiness was his love for Louisa Lattice, and that he had it under control. Marco and Louisa reunited, separated, bid final farewells to each other, then glimpsed each other on the beach in August, maintained silence and never spoke. And then, when they could bear it no longer.
I think you're the best part of my life, The part without all the lies, the deceit and aggravation. The part I can dream of at night. Because I still dream of you. Will it remain a dream? Will it happen? Will anything happen? I'm here, waiting. I don't want to do anything. I want things to just happen by themselves. That's rather shitty logic, I know, because nothing ever happens to me. But I can't make a decision. Not about this thing, not right now. I know you'll understand, because you're like me. We love in the same way, you and I. We're terrified to hurt those around us.
I still love you, Louisa. I have always loved you, and the idea of losing you again is breaking my heart, but I understand what happened. What is happening? I understand, and there's nothing I can do about it. I can accept your decision to never see each other again, I really can. We were very good at not being together, and when we finally had a chance to be together, we failed.
I miss you. You won't think I'm crazy, will you? Or a hypocrite, or worse, for writing to you like this out of the blue. It's just that I miss you. All it took is one summer, just one, without seeing you in Bulgari to leave me gasping for breath. I've realized that even just catching a glimpse of you on the beach, like I've always done for the last 25 years, even just a quick chat with you is essential to me. I held out for 3 years. Now I can't hold out anymore. Up to you if you want to answer or not. Know that I will understand if you don't, because I was the one who walked away from you. I haven't forgotten about that. I'm sorry, Marco. I messed up. I'm sorry.
It is so wonderful to receive your letter and hear your voice again, my dear, dear Louisa. You find me almost at the end of my tether. I'm a single parent now since my daughter came back to live with me. Adele is 18 now and a most wonderful young woman. My parents are both very poorly. I feel that they are in a race to the end. I am run off my feet. I shuttle back and forth to spend the day with Papa, to take Mama out for dinner, to take Adele climbing on the Appian Alps, then drive down to Bulgari to have dinner with Papa and go fishing with him the following morning. It's complicated. And suddenly it's August and the entire family has gathered here in Bulgari as if by divine command. Even Giacomo has come home from the US. Having him here feels so strange and so familiar. He left such a void.
I still love you too, Marco. I thought I'd ruined everything. I'm so glad that wasn't the case. I love you so much. I'm sad to hear about your parents, and I really admire you for what you're doing. I've been there too, when it happened with my father 2 years ago. But both of your parents at once, that's crazy.
I'm still torn, Louisa. I'm still ripped in two. On the one hand, I'm happy there is a place in the world where you'll receive this letter. On the other, I'm sad because that place is not here. Where I woke up, where I'm writing to you, where I live and will live every day.
They started writing to each other again, as they'd done for half their lives. Old-fashioned letters, written with fountain pens. Letters full of love, of dreams, of anecdotes about their children, and even of future plans. Although, in that respect, experience had taught them both to exercise caution. In short, the wonderful world of Marco and Louisa's impossible love, which shone so bright when they were apart. Marco's mother was the first of his parents to cross the line. Luisa came from Paris for her funeral. Once Luisa was there, in the flesh, next to Marco, she appeared hesitant again, so distant from the passionate tone of her letters. Despite there being no real obstacles, they barely touched. They kissed once, on the mouth, clingingto each other as the hearse carried the coffin away. But it was a light, clandestine kiss, tongues barely touching. Talking about such things in those circumstances would have been clearly inappropriate, so Marco let it go, but he was still taken aback by it. Giacomo left for America the day after the funeral, with a bag containing a handful of his mother's ashes in his suitcase. He was on the same flight to Paris as Luisa, and from there on a connecting flight to JFK. As a result, Marco ended up driving them to the airport and watching them leave together, his brother and the love of his life. It was only after he'd said goodbye, as they walked away and Giacomo said something to her, and she shook her head to one side like she did when she laughed, it was only then that he realized that the same radiant aura that surrounded Luisa when she was with him surrounded her when she was with Giacomo as well. Because that aura was made of the same memories, the same light, the same intimacy. As he watched them walk away, for the first time in his life, at the age of 45 and 3 days after losing his mother, Marco realized that it didn't matter which Carrera brother Luisa was with, the result remained unchanged. Everything that was truly resplendent in her, everything he thought he alone could see, came from those distant summers when he'd fallen in love with her as he watched her grow, sunbathe, run, and dive into the sea on that rugged stretch of coast. But Giacomo, he realized, had been there too.
Come on, Papa. Let me give you a hand. That's it, you're standing. That's good.
With Giacomo gone, it fell to Marco to manage his father, now almost entirely consumed by cancer, yet still angrily clinging to life. Stupefied by his pain management regime and tormented by his wife dying before him, he couldn't find peace, day or night.
You promised me.
And so, caving in to his father's relentless pleas,
take me away.
Marco gave him a first injection of morphine sulfate, not included in his doctor's pain management protocol.
Take me away.
Laid down next to him on the bed, and asked if he was ready to move to a new country. His father mumbled that he was. Then he fell asleep. And at that point, Marco Carrera, qualified medical practitioner since 1984, ophthalmologist since 1988, did what he had to do with his father's cannula and Dr. Capelli's morphine. Despite coming from the same furnace, the ashes delivered to Marco after the cremation were much darker and coarser than his mother's.
Dear Luisa, what you told me about Giacomo yesterday, after all these years, really horrified me. Why did you let me believe Giacomo was running away from me when in fact he was running away from you? I can see why you didn't say anything back then. You were 16. It was all so much bigger than you. But why didn't you say anything in all this time? Shall I make you a list of all the occasions you could have told me? All those moments are etched in my memory, and you weren't a little girl then, you were a woman. You had 2 children, you were about to divorce, you could have told me. Now, I have to look back on a big chunk of my life and reprocess it from scratch in light of what, until yesterday, you had kept from me for all these years. At the airport together, why didn't you tell me then? Why didn't you tell me that Giacomo had always been in love with you too? That that was the real reason he ran away? And that while he ignored all the emails I kept sending him year after year, hoping he'd forgive me, he was writing to you instead. I tallied it up, Louisa, and it turns out we broke up one more time than we got together. I swear. Let's consider the matter closed once and for all. Farewell, Marco. September 14th, 2008. Subject, Piazza Savonarola inventory. Dear Giacomo, you keep ignoring me and I keep writing. I intend to keep you informed of my efforts to sell the family house, and rest assured, I won't be deterred by your silence. The news is, I asked for a valuation of all the pieces in the flat. As I thought, there are a few gems in there, and the total estimate is really rather impressive, almost 100,000 euro. We need to decide what we want to do with them when we sell the house. We could divide them up between the two of us based on what we need or like. Do please give some thought to this, Giacomo, because as I'm sure you realise, it's not just about the money. This is all that's left of a life and a family that are no more, but that you and I were a part of for over 20 years. Though things went the way they did, there's no reason, believe me, to get rid of them, like you said the last time, rubbing salt in the wound. Hugs, Marco. Giacomo, I blamed you for Irene's death, for letting her go out alone, and it was awful of me to blame you. But it's been 30 years, for God's sake. I apologise for blaming you. I apologise for making our family's life even more unbearable than it already was for so many days. Days that kept piling up on top of each other, and yet were still too close to that wretched day. But it's been 30 years. We were boys, now we're men. We couldn't be strangers even if we wanted to. Answer me. Marco.
Is this still Dr. Carrera's number, by any chance? It's Dr. Caradori here. I'd like to speak to you. Hello?
Dr. Caradori. Dr. Carrera here. It's been a long time. What can I do for you?
Hello again, Dr. Carrera. Yeah, thank you for returning my call.
My pleasure.
To cut a long story short, you could tell me how it all went, unless you have any objections to that.
How what went?
Your life. Yours and your wife's and your daughter's. All these years.
Really?
Yes. But perhaps it's easier if I tell you about my life first. Would that be okay?
Of course.
Because a few months after our encounter, shall we say, 10 years ago, I quit my job. Done. A clean cut. But let's just say, to make things easier, that I couldn't slot back into the system I'd left behind when I came to see you.
So what do you do now?
I've joined a WHO program that offers counselling to communities hit by natural disasters and the like.
Impressive.
It's a real job, Dr. Carrera. A useful job. Helping people who've lost everything to make sense of their lives. It is the most useful thing I've ever done.
I believe you.
But I confess that on several occasions throughout these years, I often found myself thinking of you.
Really? Why?
I thought many times that I never knew what had become of you. Adele, your daughter, and Marina, your wife.
Ex-wife. We're divorced. She didn't kill me, as you can see.
That's something, I guess.
Nor I her.
Good. So, what did happen?
Well, quite a few things happened. For starters, everything she did behind my back came out.
And what you did behind hers?
Yes, that too. And we split up. You know, for all the horrible things she did to me, I can't hold it against her now. She's literally in pieces. She's like a ghost.
And Adele?
She took Adele with her, but it didn't work out, and the following year, Adele came back to Italy to live with me. She's been with me since she was 11.
And how have you managed with her, all by yourself? Have you stayed in Rome?
Dr. Caradori, I'm not sure I can give you a detailed account of the past 10 years over the phone.
Just tell me if you're living a normal life, the two of you. Just tell me this one thing.
Well, yes, we live an almost normal life. I'm a single parent with my daughter. She's 21 now.
You made it then.
I don't know that you can say that for sure, but yes, we're still standing.
When his daughter Adele, aged 11, returned from Marina, her mother, to live with Marco, he put aside everything to look after her. He became an exemplary single parent.
Hi, Dad, I'm home.
Marco constantly kept his head down.
Hi, Dad.
Waking at dawn, working like a dog, doing the shopping,
Dad,
cooking,
what's for tea?
Taking care of a million daily chores and still going to work full time.
Bye, love you, Dad.
Despite his packed schedule, he managed to carve out moments of unadulterated peace and enjoyment.
Love you, Dad.
Undeterred by tragic memories,
Dad!
Every summer he took Adele to Bulgari,
Dad!
Where nothing had changed in 40 years.
I'm here.
So she could fall in love with the sea, as he had done. He took her skiing in winter, simply letting her enjoy the thrill of gravity and teaching her how to do it safely. Adele repaid his efforts by growing up healthy and full of life, getting good grades in the same schools he'd attended, avoiding the usual scrapes kids her age got into.
Yeah, all right, Dad.
And keeping fit.
Dad, I'm going climbing.
She discovered a real talent for free climbing. When she was 21...
Dad, I'm pregnant. The baby will be called Mirai Jean, which in Japanese means man of the future.
The baby would be born on the 20th of October, 2010.
And it will be born on a special day.
That is, for those who care about these things, and Adele Carrera did care, on 2010, 2010.
I get all that. But who's the father?
I'm sorry, but I'm not going to tell you, Dad.
But I mean... But why? How come? How do you think you'll... Who will look after you and the baby?
I have no intention of leaving you, Dad. You've been a fantastic father to me. You still are. And if you're a fantastic father to me, then you can be a father for Mirai Jean, too. The man of the future.
Marco, I know you won't write back, but I came across this passage and it made my heart burst because it's about you. Aztec warriors who die in battle would join the sun in his daily fight against the darkness. But after 4 years, they would turn into hummingbirds. So the highest aspiration after a heroic death is to be a hummingbird. I miss you.
For the time being, it was up to Marco Carrera to meet his daughter's expectations. He followed his heart and embraced the idea fully. And so it was that at 11 a.m. on the 20th of October 2010, Adele's forecast turned out to be correct, and Marco found himself immersed in lukewarm water with his daughter and Norma, the midwife. It all happened much faster than Marco had expected. When the baby had been pushed out, and the midwife held it underwater for another 10, 20, 30 seconds, Marco felt no anxiety, no impatience. That water held them together and spoke to them and reassured them. Those 30 seconds were the most enlightened in his entire life. That murky broth they swam in was the only happy family he'd ever known. He sat there speechless, etching in his memory the moment Mirai Jean drew her first calm breath, uttered her first cry, opened her eyes for the first time, and he didn't even realize it was a girl. As she turned to Marco, Adele had a look of fulfillment on her face that every father should see in his children at least once.
See, Dad, we're off to a very good start. The man of the future is a woman.
Then the call came. The phone call all parents fear like hell. It came for our friend, Marco. The phone call that obliterated his life back to zero. Except life is the opposite of zero. And in fact, Mirai Jin was asleep on his lap. In that moment, Mirai Jin, who'd turned two the month before, softly woke up and smiled at him. And by doing so, by simply waking up and smiling at him, she said, "Don't even think about it, Grandpa," she said. "I mean it," she said. "Grandpa, I'm here, and you must go on."
Hello?
Hello, is this Dr. Caradori? It's Dr. Carrera.
Hello, Dr. Carrera. I'm in Lampedusa, and the line isn't great. Can you hear me?
I can. I don't know how to tell you. I really don't. I mean, I don't know how to tell you without being brutal.
Then be brutal.
Adele.
Adele?
Is dead.
Dear God, no.
She is. She died 8 days ago. An accident on the Appian Alps, one of those freak accidents that shouldn't happen according to climbers. And that in Adele's case is really horrific.
Why?
Because her rope broke, that's why. While she was climbing, it was rubbing against the rock. Snap. Broken. Except the rope is not supposed to break, ever. It's made of polyester with high tensile strength. It can't break. I'm sorry.
I'm listening.
There's a reason I bothered you, Dr. Caradori. Adele's mother, Marina, my ex-wife, your former patient.
Ah, yes.
I don't know how to handle her. I haven't even got Adele's body back yet because it's still being held by the police. And I barely have enough strength to face the funeral when I do eventually get it back. How am I going to tell these people?
Then don't. Don't do anything you don't feel like doing.
There's something else, but I'm a bit... I'm sorry. I'm on anti-anxiety medication.
Don't worry.
I was saying there's something else.
Yes.
Well, 2 years ago, Adele had a little girl. We don't know who the father is. Adele never told anyone. The child is just wonderful. I'm not saying this because she's my granddaughter, Dr. Caradori. It's just that she really is a new, different kind of person. She's dark-skinned with Japanese features, curly hair and blue eyes. As if she is African, Asian and European all at once. Can you see what I mean?
Yes, I think so.
I'm her grandfather, but also a father of sorts.
Of course.
And clearly, it's only because of her that I'm still here fighting Dr. Caradori. If it wasn't for her, I'd have jumped off a cliff already.
Well, thank God she's here then.
I don't have the strength to handle this.
I do. And you know what? You did the right thing calling me, because I can help you. I'll talk to your ex-wife's doctor in Germany, and I'll talk to Marina, too.
But how? You're in Lampedusa, and you've got work to...
Look, I got here tonight, but I'm actually not due back at work until next...
But that's too much. I really wouldn't know how...
It's my job, after all. Looking after people in an emergency. You have to look after yourself now. You have to find a reason to get out of bed every morning.
Well, for that, I've got Mirai Jin.
No. No, you have to find that reason inside you. If you were to look after your granddaughter while dead inside, that's what she'd learn from you. But if you fight to keep yourself alive, and it doesn't matter if you succeed or not, trying is enough. Then you'll pass that determination onto her. And that determination is, quite simply, life itself. Believe me, every day, I look after people who have lost everything. They're often the only survivors in their whole family. They have all kinds of material problems. Sometimes they're gravely ill. But do you know what we work on?
No. Please, tell me.
We work on desires, on pleasure. Because even in the most disastrous of situations, these things endure. Yet we actively try to suppress them, even though they're the one thing that can save us. Do it. It won't solve a single one of your problems, but it won't make them worse either. And meanwhile, you will have escaped the dictatorship of pain.
So what should I do?
Do you still play tennis?
I do.
Play tennis then, for example.
Easy for you to say. And what about Mirai Jean?
Bring the child along and look after her while you do what you love.
I am so very grateful for this, Dr. Caradori. I really am.
Text me everything I need then, please. Addresses, contacts, and so on.
I'll do it straight away, Dr. Caradori.
Good. And tomorrow, I'll be on my way.
Goodbye, Dr. Caradori. And thank you for everything.
Hang in there. See you soon.
See you soon. Louisa. Adele is dead. My Adele is dead, and I can't follow her because of the little one. Help me, Louisa. I can't go on this time. I've been hit by a grenade. It's just one grenade after the other now. Here they come. Evil. Is there something like a fast track for evil, or does it just hit people at random, I wonder? Here they come. The mists of oblivion.
Marco started playing tennis again. Over 50s tournaments across Tuscany, then over 55s, and then the doubles. His opponents were the same as when he was a kid, except they had less hair, and they played without a referee at night.
Paris, 19th of December 2018. Marco, you really are a hummingbird. It's so obvious. It's a revelation to me. You really are a hummingbird, and not because you were so little. You are a hummingbird because all your energy is spent keeping still. 70 wing beats per second, only to remain where you are. And you truly are formidable at this. You can keep still as time flows around you. You can stop it flowing. Sometimes you can turn back time even. Just like a hummingbird, you can fly backwards and retrieve lost time. That's why being with you is so beautiful. But expending all that energy just to keep still can sometimes be the evil itself rather than the cure. That's why being with you is impossible. I've spent my entire life wondering why you'd never managed to do what you most wanted to do, why you couldn't take that step you needed to take to be with me. I wondered what part of you would always suck you back every time we got so close to being together, and that happened a few times over the years. Why you'd suddenly push away everything you'd so desperately tried to grasp up until that very moment. Today I realized I'm the one who never managed to be with you. Because in order to be with you, you have to keep still. And I was never able to do that. We've missed each other in all the possible meanings of the term, but this new perspective on our relationship fills me with anguish. Marco, I hear loud bangs, ambulances, people screaming outside my window. It's Saturday, and like every Saturday, it's the end of the world here in Paris. But that's just the way it is now. Yellow vests protesting everywhere. But that's just the way it is now. Being without you is just the way it is now. Merry Christmas, Louisa.
Florence, 27th of December, 2018. Dear Louisa, yes, I too believe we could have been together if only you'd been able to keep still. But we cannot change who we are, and if I'm a hummingbird, you're a lion. Or a gazelle. I have a mission now, Something that gives meaning to everything I ever did and didn't do, including you. I'm raising the man of the future. That is, the 8-year-old girl who lives here. That's all the strength I've got left now, just enough to raise her and answer you one last time. I'm sorry, Louisa, but this is the last letter I'll write to you. I have loved you so much. You know I have. For 40 years, you have been the first and the last thing I thought about. Every single day. But not anymore. My first thought is for her now. And the last. And all the thoughts in between. This is the only way I can live now. Hugs. Marco.
There was nothing Mirajin didn't show an aptitude for, right from the beginning. Every time she tried a new sport, from tennis to judo, she would astonish her instructors with her natural talent. At school, teachers were amazed by her ability to focus, and to help her classmates focus too. Her drawing skills were outstanding.
Mirajin, do you realize that every time you try something new, you can do it straight away? How do you do that?
I just look at how my teacher does it.
That body of hers was so charismatic precisely because it knew how to imitate other bodies itself. And so it was that Marco, at the tender age of 60, began scrupulously checking his behavior, his moves, even the way he spoke, like he'd never done before. He was determined to purge his life of all the faulty elements that might blemish his granddaughter. Starting with him, then. Starting with Marco Carrera, Mirajin had begun changing the world.
And you, Grandpa? What will you do?
I will keep doing what I've always done. I'll stand still with my feet firmly planted on the ground, and I will try as hard as I can to stop time.
10 years on, you'll go see him and find he's still keeping well, still keeping active, keeping still, in short, what he does best, while everything around him changes, and yet knowing all too well that change will come for him too, all at once, all of a sudden. And change does come, and it's not a change for the better, because it takes the shape of a medical report, and the diagnosis is a pancreatic carcinoma, an aggressive cancer, already at a quite advanced stage. He's 70, and he's got cancer. And it's a tough one, damn it. And Mirajin's knees will buckle when he tells her, and the world she is carrying on her shoulders will crumble around her.
Dear Grandpa, please ignore what I said yesterday. I was desperate. I couldn't sleep. But now I understand. I understand everything, and I'm ready. All these years, you have given me everything and never asked for anything in return. So if for once you ask something of me, even something as huge as this, I won't let you down. Today I'm here. I'm here for you. I'll get you to where you want to go, simple as that. And we'll be together. I am yours, Mirajin.
And now we come to the last key event in this tale of many tales. We are in Marco's house in Bulgari. It is the summer of 2030. Marco is in his father's old room, the most beautiful in the house, with French windows overlooking the garden. Louisa is out there. Marco can see her through the thin curtain. She's talking to Giacomo. He's there too. Marco hasn't spoken to Louisa in so long. How long exactly? He can't remember. Giacomo has come from America, Louisa from Paris, and then there is Rodrigo, the nurse who's come to do the deed. The rooms are carefully prepared. There is freshly caught fish, homemade pasta, and vegetables from the garden, even though Marco, in his current state, is not able to partake. Marco hoists himself up into a sitting position. Stabbing pain again. It's time for his morphine tablets. Pain aside, Marco could still be self-sufficient. He's very far from the actual end yet. He hasn't yet turned into a zombie like his parents did, and he never will. He wants to leave before he becomes a nuisance.
Rodrigo, take me to the garden, please. I want to do it there.
It's a bright, balmy afternoon. The hedge is in bloom, as are the bougainvillea and the jasmine. The lawn has been mown that very same morning, and the freshly cut grass adds to that intoxicating combination of scents. Luisa steps away from Giacomo to meet him.
Marco.
Marco looks at her, radiant in the sun that has just about begun to set. She's still incredibly beautiful. Giacomo walks behind her. He too loved that body and that face. He too is still beautiful. Something to watch out for. Melancholy. He's nervous. His heart is pounding. The whole point in the end is for him to go while he still looks passable, for him to leave before the horror sets in. No one says a word until Rodrigo returns from the house carrying the drugs. As he hooks the bags onto the IV stand and plugs them into the cannulas, Marco begins to speak.
Thank you for coming. I'm very happy to have you here with me. As you know, inviting you was Mirai Jean's idea, and since you're all here, I assume you thought it was a good idea. You don't have to watch if you don't want to. I'm very happy to have seen you and talked to you all. Anyway, if you'd rather go back into the house now, or to the beach, or wherever, please don't feel you have to stay. I'd like to say a few words to explain the medical side of things, and so you understand that this is entirely my own decision, which I have made in full possession of my mental faculties. The first bag on the IV stand and plugged into the cannula on my right arm contains a combination of midazolam, a benzodiazepine medication, and propofol, which will cause a loss of consciousness. The second bag contains concentrated potassium. That's going to do the dirty work. I'm not going to tell you how I obtained these substances, but I can assure you that no one knew what use I intended to make of them. Once I've said goodbye to everyone, I'll open the red tap and the anesthetics will begin flowing through my veins. Once they've kicked in, Rodrigo will kindly open the other tap, the blue one, which will let the potassium in, and it'll all be over in a matter of minutes. All you'll see is me nodding off. Rodrigo is here, so I don't miss the best part. That is, softly sinking into oblivion.
Done. His speech is over. Marco is very proud of himself. Proud he remembered everything. Proud he explained everything professionally. Mirai Jin strokes his hair, like he stroked hers so many times before.
Well done, Grandpa.
Then moves to stand next to his wheelchair on the opposite side to Rodrigo, who, silent, enigmatic, holds the IV stand like a spear. He's ready. Giacomo comes forward. Brother embraces brother.
I'm sorry.
No. I'm sorry.
They let go. That's it. Done. It's Luisa's turn now. Here she comes. Marco's heart starts pounding again. Her silver-green eyes, her sun-drenched brown hair still glowing.
Mon petit colibri. My little hummingbird.
And then, her head tilted to one side, her hair falling on her shoulder. That languid look, Marco knows it well. The same as all those years before when she... A kiss. On the mouth. She holds his head in her hands, passionately. Who cares if they're old, if Giacomo sees them, if everyone sees them? Marco grabs her head too and holds her close. And God bless the jab of pain down his side. He wanted to kiss her too. It's what he's always wanted, always. He wanted to kiss her for the first time in that very spot, 50 years before, and he never stopped wanting it since. He would never have dared, though, not on this day, but she dared. It's over. Louisa stirs, straightens her back, and retreats to her seat, head bowed, as if she'd just taken communion.
It's time. Nothing else left to do.
The afternoon is intoxicating, brimming with light, abuzz with life. A light breeze blows in from the sea.
I can't feel any pain.
Something else to watch out for. Second thoughts. Maybe that's what they're all secretly hoping for. That he'll change his mind. That he'll pretend to believe he can beat cancer. That he'll start another round of chemo, start fighting again. That he'll endure the endless nausea and the diarrhea and the mouth sores. That Mirajin, instead of saving the world, will rush to hire water mattresses and night nurses and buy massage oils and various other ointments and morphine tablets and morphine injections, more and more morphine, because after a while it's not enough anymore, but not too much because it's not allowed. And that he'll beg Mirajin to take him away, like his father begged him, and that Mirajin, instead of saving the world, will have to... Marco turns towards Rodrigo and shakes his hand.
Thank you for everything.
Rodrigo squeezes his shoulder. Marco reaches for the red tap, jab of pain, and opens it. Then rests his hand back on his thigh, jab of pain. He takes a good look at the people sitting in front of him, then glances up at Mirajin and gestures for her to lean forward. She does. He looks at that incredible girl for the last time, then lifts his arm, pain again, and touches her hair. Mirajin holds his gaze, wearing a resolute, knowing expression. The drugs are beginning to kick in. Everything starts pulling away from him. Everything is so, so far away. Fluctuating, aquatic peace.
Irene. Adele. Papa. Mama. This young woman is my gift to the world. Are you proud of me?
He's asleep now. His head flops to one side. Mirajin holds it up, protects it.
Marco, suppose I say summer. Write the word hummingbird. Put it in an envelope. Take it down the hill to the box. When you open my letter, you will recall those days and how much, just how much, I love you. Louisa.
The Hummingbird by Sandro Veronese, translated by Elena Parla, was adapted by John Retallack. The Hummingbird poem is by Raymond Carver. The author was played by Paul Ansdell, Marco by Simon Lenigan, Louisa by Caroline Faber. Dr. Caradori was played by Dan Crickler, Adele by Katie Walton, and Mirajin by Darcy Dixon. The sound design was by John Nichols. The Hummingbird was directed by John Retallack and produced by Emma Balch, for the story of books.
The BBC Proms 2022. Come for the phenomenal musicians. Or for your favourite works. To hear orchestras from across the world. Or just for some good fun. There are so many reasons to come to the BBC Proms. Tickets are now available. Head to the Proms website to start planning your summer of music.
Good evening from me, Chris Barrow. Now at 8:30, it's tonight's Radio 3 in concert. And there was a full house at the Barbican Hall in London back in February when the Canadian singer and songwriter Patrick Watson and band members joined the BBC Symphony Orchestra and its creative artist in association, Jules Buckley, for a concert of some of Patrick Watson's finest songs. You can find all the details of the songs and artists on tonight's Radio 3 In Concert homepage. You can also read the digital programme of tonight's Radio 3 In Concert. Just look that up there. And on the BBC Symphony Orchestra's own website, you can search for Patrick Watson, BBC Symphony Orchestra and Barbican. All the details are there. So let's hand things over to Patrick.